So it's my great pleasure to introduce Gil Bergerano, who has had a very exciting paper come out just a few weeks ago. And so we're very lucky to get him here. And I think he's going to tell us about that as well as some of his new work. Great.
So we're good. Okie dokie. Okay, so thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me to this session. And let's start amusing you. So let's see. So I thought I'd start by telling you a bit about the interest of the lab. So here's the lab goal. So our goal is to understand the function, evolution, and disease implications of every base in the human genome. We don't write that at the AIMS portion of our grant, but that is what interests us. The lab has done a fair bit of medical genomics recently. I'll tell you some of these stories. We're also very much interested in the genomics behind human and animal adaptations. I thought for the interest of time, I'll focus mostly on medical genomics today, but we do a lot of that. And we definitely have been working for a long time in gene regulation and have a lot of interest there. The lab bridges computation, basic science, and translational science, even by our affiliations, which are computer science, developmental biology, and pediatrics. You can see that. We have a strong preference of recently to do computational genomics. We've done more wet, dry combinations before, but now we're mostly focused on computation, which is a good bridge for a lot of collaborations and tons of data that are out there that are pretty fun to work with. And we've really embraced the preprint era, so I'll use that later in the talk today. So if you go to our lab website, there's about 6 of these preprints out there. Send us comments, talk to us. It's an awesome venue where, you know, you can get acknowledged in the paper. You can maybe even, we can even co-author one. We'll send you a t-shirt, depending on what the comments are. So preprints are out there. Certainly our publications are out there as well. So today I thought I'd show you what happened when you mix a field like medical genomics with some computer science. So we'll do medical genomics plus natural language processing to begin with, and then we'll do medical genomics plus cryptography to kind of wrap up. Time permitting. Okay, let's do it. So one of the fields that we work the most with in the context of medical genomics is the field of Mendelian diseases, right? So these are conceptually the simplest form of disease, or at least the simplest form of disease causes, which are one or two mutations to a single gene. Because there is beautiful code reuse in our genome, you can hit a single gene and you can get very complex phenotypes because the same gene is used in multiple tissues, in multiple contexts. So you can get very complicated phenotypes even from relatively simple bugs in the genetic code itself. Mendelian diseases in aggregate are thought to affect about 3% of newborns. So it's a very large number when you aggregate over all of the thousands of different known ways to break individual genes and what that leads to. So we've done a fair bit of work in this space of recently. I just mentioned some things. We've put out a clinical grade, the first clinical grade pathogenicity classifier for variants of unknown significance, where we show that we can actually provide 95% accuracy and still eliminate 60% of variants of unknown significance from the pool. We've also shown that many other pathogenicity classifiers are dialed not in a very good way, so they would miss out 25 to almost 40% of known pathogenic variants. They would just call them likely benign. So you wouldn't want to work with tools like that in the clinic, whereas these are levels where, you know, I think clinical work is much more comfortable with levels like this. We've also shown, we were the first ones to show in publication where if you have, you know, we are now, when we started out in the field a few years ago, the field was able to solve about 10% of Mendelian cases that we sent out to sequencing. Now that number has gone up to about 30%. And we were the first one to show that if you just take your undiagnosed cases where you've sequenced and you've tried to find the causal gene, but you couldn't, and you waited 1 to 2 years, and you didn't call the patient back in, you didn't tell the patient, didn't promise anything, all you did was reanalyze the patient in light of new data, you could solve an extra 10 to 15% of cases just by virtue of new information that comes out in the literature about genes and diseases and how genes cause different diseases. So So that's been taken up by multiple other groups, and many novel diagnoses for patients and their families are coming about. And that, I'll touch a bit about that. We're starting to have our own fair share of novel disease genes that we play a part in discovering, which is pretty cool because it's all based on tools, computational tools that we develop in our lab. And today I want to talk to you specifically about patient diagnosis. So patient diagnosis means a clinician has looked at a patient, thought that there may be a genetic basis for the disease, send them out for exome or genome sequencing, and when that sequence comes back, what happens is variants are called, suspicious-looking variants are flagged, and at the end of the day, you essentially have a retrieval challenge, if you like, in a computer science sense. You need, for you to provide a diagnosis for your patient, you need to appreciate that your patient looks like a bunch of other patients published in the literature, and that, in fact, those patients all suffer from a mutation in a certain gene, and your patient has a mutation, in this case, in KMT2A, which also is called MLL, so you have to remember all these annoying acronyms, and you realize, wait, my patient has a mutation just like these folks, and they suffer from the same set of phenotypes, therefore I have a diagnosis. So you can imagine when you, I'll show you some real-life examples, you know, when you sequence singleton individuals, your candidate gene list can be as long as 100, and if you start with hundreds of 100 genes and a handful of phenotypes, it takes a fair bit of time. And for example, recently estimated to be about a week's work for an individual, a highly trained, highly paid individual, just to solve one of these cases. I'll show an example. So here's an example that we're going to use later in the talk. So this individual suffers from ptosis, hearing loss, and joint contraction. And when you sequence their exome, you find rare, potentially pathogenic variants in 124 genes. So this is where a clinician typically starts. They have 124 genes, and they have a set of phenotypes, and they want to link the two to each other. Anybody wants to take a guess on what's the disease gene? Right, so, but that's what they do, day in and day out. They use a method that we fondly call a Dr. Google approach. Dr. Google means you take a doctor, and you put him in front of Google, and you say, you know, hey, Google away. Google about some of these genes. Read about these phenotypes, try to get some kind of a differential diagnosis, see which genes are associated with that differential diagnosis. Maybe you can link back to these guys, right? It's a long and laborious process. It matches what non-computer scientists arguably would think about how to use the computer as a portal for all the information out there, except for us as computer scientists, it's natural to say, dude, you know, we can do better for you. We can bring all the literature over to you, rank all of that, and offer you a ranked choice that will take you to a diagnosis much, much faster. And this is kudos to XKCD from which we adapted this slide. So let me show you this intelligent augmentation that we are doing now. So, right, so the idea is you have a retrieval challenge, right? You want to appreciate that your patient looks like something that's been published before. So the natural place to start at is PubMed. So PubMed has about 26, maybe now even 27 million abstracts and titles, which you can get. We train a classifier. So we have to have full text, as you'll see in a minute. So the first thing we do is we train a classifier to appreciate which papers talk about Mendelian diseases and which papers don't. So here's the example. We take training examples of patients that say mutations in this gene cause this set of phenotypes. And then as negative examples, we use papers that are irrelevant for Mendelian diseases. This is one that my students enjoy pointing out. It has over 1,000 citations from the lab, but has nothing to do with Mendelian diseases, right? So off it goes into the negative examples. So after you've trained that, you end up from 26 million, you can reduce your challenge to about 500,000 papers that seem to be about Mendelian disease genes and say gene X cause phenotype Y1, Y2, Y3. The numbers have actually improved since. We can now download over 90% of full text. So publishers have recently been pushed to offer APIs to paying institutions that will allow them to do exactly what it is that we're doing here. And we've capitalized on that and written software that allows us to get 90%+ of full text of these documents. Okay? So now we start extracting all the information we need from these full text documents. So we extract genes. So we have long tables of gene names and acronyms. You can see there's all kinds of acronyms for these genes, which makes the human matching process quite difficult. We extract them from all over the paper. Similarly, we extract phenotypes, from the papers. So we have long lists of phenotypes, and we lemmatize them and do a couple other tricks. And we extract all of these from the papers as well. You can see the numbers flash as I go through it. And at the end of the day, we also have trained a classifier that tries to decide for each paper which gene is the causal gene discussed in the paper. And when we classify the causal gene, we link the phenotypes with that gene. Okay? So now essentially what we've done here is we've taken all of PubMed and we've created from it a huge database that links genes to the phenotypes they cause through papers. Okay? Genes, papers, and phenotypes. And remember, our task is to ask, is there a paper about a gene that best explains our patient? So this is what we're going to do next. Okay, we have the knowledge base that we just created. We have a patient. You can see a typical patient that's been sequenced as a singleton, just sequencing the candidate, the proband, I should say, themselves, typically come with about 100, even sometimes even 200 candidate genes with suspicious-looking rare mutations, and on average, about a median of 7 phenotypes per case. The system ranks about 2,000 papers per each of these cases. And as I'll show you in a second, the idea at the end is that you rank the genes by the best paper that matches your patient, and you want the gene that you know to cause the disease if you use a set of benchmarking to come up as close as possible to the top of the list. So I'll show you some numbers in a second. So the idea here is that we use an information theoretic measurement to essentially go over for every gene in the patient list. We go over every paper associated with it, and we look at the phenotypes in the paper and try to assess how well do they explain the phenotypes in the patient. And we use, there's a beautiful HPO DAG, directed acyclic graph, that gives you a structure over the diseases. So the match between your patient and the published results can be, doesn't have to be exact. It can be essentially integrated over this DAG, which is very powerful. And at the end of the day, when you take, for example, a patient like this and you rank on average 2,000 papers against this patient, what you get is something like this. So the number one ranking paper out of the entire corpus of 500,000 that we have is this paper that suggests that mutations MYH3, which is one of the genes mutated in your patient, causes this multiple pterygium syndrome, and that is indeed what your patient suffers from. Okay, so the idea is that before the busy clinician ever looks at this case, the computer has done all this ranking for them, and when they turn it on, the computer says, look, you know, 124 genes, 3 phenotypes, and we think you should look at papers in this order, and arguably, if you find that MYH3 is the right diagnosis, you can move very quickly from there just to make sure that nothing has been missed in any other context, right? So this is a bit, you know, I don't know. It's a bit like P equals NP, P and NP challenges in some ways. You know, it's, if I give you a graph and I ask you, dude, is there a Hamiltonian path in there? If you guys remember, Hamiltonian path covers all nodes without repeating them twice. It actually takes a long time for humans even to do that. But if I show you a Hamiltonian path and I ask you, hey, is that a Hamiltonian path? You'd be like, yeah, fairly easy, right? So it's clearly Hamiltonian path. So with this accelerates clinician time by an order of over 10x, right? They open the system, they see that, they have a diagnosis. I'll show you in a second what we do there. So it doesn't just speed the thing up, it actually, the system itself beats in a very nice way all these other methods, all of which are based on manually curated databases. So here, people have invested thousands of hours reading the primary literature and typing out, well, this gene causes that in this PMID, this gene causes that in that PMID, et cetera. So our system does much better than those. So there's an app for it. We call the app Amelie for two reasons. One is the acronym is automatic Mendelian literature evaluation. We also like this movie. If you haven't seen the movie, it's a very charming movie. And the logo or whatever for the movie is she'll change your Amelie, she'll change your life. So you know, when you work with clinicians, you learn to appreciate that a medical diagnosis really changes the patient and their family's life. So we hope tools like this will really change people's life for the better. All right, so let me show you very quickly. You can use, for example, populate the tool with our demo, list of genes. You can give a VCF or you can give a gene list, list of genes, list of phenotype. You hit submit. When you hit submit, the system says, look, you know, here's the set of phenotypes that you've described for me. here's the list of candidate genes that you gave me. And when all this processing that I described before happens, you get this ranked list that is aggregated on the gene. So you can see here, KMT2A here has a score of the best matching paper has a score of 26.6, the next one 10.5, et cetera. The fourth best paper already talks about another gene, but you can go down this gene list. In this particular case, KMT2A is indeed the diagnosis for the child that I showed you. And if you click on the link for the top paper, what the clinician very quickly sees is essentially why it is that we think this is the case, right? So we tell them, look, you know, you told us your patient suffers from renal tubular acidosis. We find in the paper abnormality of the kidney, recurrent urinary tract infection, and acidosis, right? So you can see that the match is not perfect. The match is done via the DAG, which is very powerful and essentially is what the clinicians themselves do. So list of phenotypes in the patient, list of phenotypes in the paper, and if there was a key phenotype that was missing in the paper, we would highlight that for the clinician as well. There are other nice features for clinicians, like you can, for example, require certain phenotypes and not require other ones to narrow down the list, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not just an app. Should I take a question or should I? Let's keep that to the end. I got good advice before the session started. So let's keep the question to the end. There's an API for it. So people have started submitting hundreds of jobs. If you are in this business, we encourage you. You can incorporate our logic into your tools by simply submitting, getting back the results, and posting them for your own audiences. All right, so this ends the first part, okay? And second part, we'll continue in this theme of, you know, finding things of meaning in the genome. So another, right, I showed you how we can accelerate the diagnosis of patients against the literature using natural language processing. This is done when you align your patient to pre-existing cases that have been published before. But the question is, how do new disease genes come into being? Well, there's a very powerful way of discovering novel disease genes in Mendelian context, which is using these small cohorts of unrelated individuals. So if you have 3 or 4 or 7 or 10 individuals that you think may suffer from the same disease, so the set of phenotypes they have is quite similar, you can sequence that small pool of individuals and simply look for the gene that is mutated in most of them. Does that make sense? So for example, here are seven kids. All of them seem to suffer from this disease that's called for the two physicians who first classified the disease, Hajduchenny syndrome. And if you exome sequence all seven of them and you just ask, give me the rare potentially pathogenic mutations in each, and then rank them for which gene is mutated in most of my patients, the NOTCH2 gene has a suspicious-looking mutation in 6 of these 7 cases. Okay, the NOTCH2 gene was shown later to indeed be the gene causing this syndrome. So you can do it with cohorts of 7. You can see we don't always explain all patients, but we explain many of them. And sometimes even in this particular case, you could take this in the 7th one. We appreciate actually belongs to a different syndrome. So it wasn't even supposed to be in this pool, and we pulled them elsewhere and gave them a different diagnosis. Here are a few other examples, the same theme, right? If you can collect a few unrelated individuals who suffer from the same set of phenotypes, and you tally this for the gene, you will at every time or many times when it's Mendelian, find the causal gene, okay? All right. So, you know, this is a case where essentially you take unrelated individuals and their families, and you find the causal gene from that. That's wonderful. However, to do that, you appreciate that what happens here is total strangers have to share their genomic information, not just with each other, but also with the test provider, right? So this has been the notion in genomics, certainly in Mendelian genomics, for a long time. It's an all or nothing game. You either let us sequence your genome, and then we're going to peer through it and look at it and compare it, et cetera, et cetera. Or you don't, and then we don't. So if you have any concerns about privacy and you don't want to participate in this game, you're out. You're out of luck. So it turns out this is absolutely not the case. You do not have to share your genomic information in order to perform these protocols. So there's a beautiful area of cryptography that allows people to compute exact answers together without sharing their inputs, which is a perfect match here. Okay, so I'll try to give you the gist of it, right? So for example, in this here, the computation we wanted to do is we wanted, you know, if you had a gene array vector for all of your patients, and for each patient, you just checked one if they had a suspicious looking variant in this gene. So you have a vector for each patient, and you summed all of them. You just want the arg max of that vector. You want the gene mutated in most of your patients. So you can perform the exact arg max without sharing the rows of input. And I'll try to give you a taste of it. I thought by the time we get here, I'll give you an essential taste of how this protocol, particular protocol works, right? How do you compute an exact answer without sharing the input? So just like, you know, in general CS, we have foo and bar and all kinds of other stuff. In cryptography, we have Alice and Bob, okay? So this, by the way, is we're going to illustrate here a protocol called Yao's protocol, if you've heard of it before. So imagine Alice and Bob both have, each one of them has a secret number between 1 and 10, and all they want to do is decide whether whether Bob's number is bigger than Alice's or not. They do not want to reveal their number to each other. They just want to decide whether Bob's number is bigger than Alice's or not. Make sense? All right, so here's how they do it, right? First of all, observe that there are 100 possible combinations of situations here, right? Alice could have any number between 1 and 10. Bob could have any number between 1 and 10. And in 45 of these combinations, Bob number is strictly larger. And in 55 of these combinations, Bob number is not larger. Hope that makes sense to you guys. So here's what happens. Alice prepares the following things, right? First of all, she takes 100 notes for all possible outcomes. And on every note, she writes the possible outcome. So she prepares 45 notes that say Bob number is larger. And she prepares 55 notes that says Bob's number isn't larger. She then prepares two sets of 10 keys. She prepares a set of 10 key for each of the numbers that she may be holding. And she prepares a second set of 10 keys for each of the numbers that Bob may be holding. Okay? And then what Alice does is she essentially takes each one of the 100 boxes. She puts a note inside, and she double locks it with a key for a number from her and a key for a number for Bob, okay? So essentially, for example, you can think, and she does it for all combinations. She takes a note that says Bob's number isn't larger, and she locks it with a key that matches Bob's number 9 and Alice's number 9. Because if Bob has a 9 and Alice has a 9, Bob's number is not larger, okay? So at the end of the day, 10 keys for Alice, 10 keys for Bob. All the answers, the proper answer, you know, for 10 and 10, the answer is Bob's number isn't larger. For 1 and 2, the answer is Bob's number is larger. Okay? So what happens now? What happens now is Alice places Bob's 10 keys on a table. They're all labeled 1 to 10 and leaves the room. Bob enters the room. He picks the right key for his number, and he removes the label from that key. Bob then joins Alice in the second room. In the second room, what's waiting for Bob is one unlabeled key for Alice's number and all 100 boxes shuffled in some way. So if you get where I'm going here, you know, Bob essentially has now a key for his number, a key for Alice's number. The key is not labeled, so he doesn't know what number that is. Alice doesn't know which number Bob picked out of the 10 she prepared for him. And Bob just sits down, and he starts opening. He tries to open all 100 boxes. And by design, Bob will only be able to open one box, and that box will tell you exactly whether Bob's number is larger or not. Hope that makes sense. So Bob and Alice just computed together whether Bob's number is larger without sharing the numbers between them. So that is essentially how we do it in the genome context as well. We trade keys instead of trading values. And at the end of the day, we find the single gene mutated in most patients. And we do it by making this into essentially a Boolean circuit, if you like, and running this entire computation over a Boolean circuit. Okay, so it turns out there are multiple scenarios this is good for. You can do the small cohort analysis I told you about before. You can solve it for a family. So here we did it for a trio, but we have situations where you have two sisters whose children suffer from a disease. So So when you start sharing genomic information across multiple generations, again, it becomes much more comfortable not to share it. Still get the exact diagnosis, but without sharing the genomic information. We also have a protocol there that allows hospitals to compare their suspicious-looking variants with each other, because maybe they can come up with a small code. Even when we did this test for the paper, we could find novel disease genes that have a patient in hospital A and a patient in hospital B just by running this protocol. So they can compare their notes and only see where it is that they should really talk about things together and keep all the other variants in themselves so they can, you know, further their own career and solve their own patients first, et cetera. So all of this, the bottom line is that all of this runs in seconds to minutes, in bandwidth of megabases to gigabases, extremely doable right now. So you can give people accurate diagnosis without revealing anything about their information. Okay, and with that, we'll wrap and I'll start taking questions. So I showed you two things. I showed you this tool that's called amelie.stanford.edu that allows to greatly speed up genetic diagnosis. And I've shown you that genetic diagnosis can be offered now while maintaining patient privacy, along with the paper that we put out. The code is out there. You can grab it from GitHub and start using it today. And then, well, let's not even spend time on this. Anyway, you can see I have a great admiration for the genome. That's the one genome to rule them all. I showed you a couple techniques of how to find things in the genome, and hopefully, you know, we'll make sure the genome goes in good directions and not in evil ones ever. Kudos. Kudos go to Johannes Birgmeier, who really spearheaded this project, Max Hausler, who's our collaborator, other people who joined in the project. You can see there's a preprint that you're more welcome to look at. John Bernstein, who's chief of medical genetics at Stanford. Chris Ray, who's a computer science faculty. David Cooper, Peter Stevenson from AGMD and others. The second paper was a wonderful collaboration between our lab and Dan Boneza, who's a cryptographer at Stanford. So there's a student from our lab, a student, David, and Kartik from Dan, from my lab, who really pushed this together. Here's the entire gang. And with this, I will stop and take any questions. Thank you. Please.
I think we have time for, I guess we started late. Yeah, we have time for a few questions.
Are you thinking about doing something like Amelie for cancer, somatic mutations?
Yeah, we're starting to look into cancer and talking with people. Cancer is kind of interesting. You know, it's a relatively small set of genes with a relatively huge voluminous literature, not all of it the highest quality. So it's going to be an interesting domain. We have to appreciate that there is really enough fodder there to do this, but this is generally applicable to quite a few things, and that's definitely one of the places we're thinking about. All of this, I should say, is moving away from cancer. So in fact, we trained our models away from any neoplasm in this method and focus on all other children diseases. Yeah, definitely.
Is your Hamiltonian path analogy correct all the way in the sense that when, like, in your evaluation, you say who does best? And is that just because somehow once you pick one, it's obvious that it's correct? Or what's the ground truth?
Well, the ground truth is a set of tests that I think the Hamiltonian path is an analogy, right? So let me try to show you what I mean by that. What I mean by that is that, where is that? That is it, right? So the way at least I think about it, right, when I give you a case like this, you have to start figuring out, is there a path from a gene to these phenotypes, through the literature, from the phenotypes to the gene? But if I show you this, I essentially have tried to lay out a path in front of you. I tell you, look, you know, your patient has a suspicious-looking mutation in this gene. You told me he suffers from all of these. In this case, it's a she. She suffers from all of these. Here are all the things I found in the paper for you. So here's a path. Tell me if you believe it or not.
So then I guess the question is, how's the ground truth created when you were comparing the different approaches?
Oh, we simply took solved known cases.
Oh, I see.
So you take a big pack
so
of known cases, and you
see. Is that very biased then? I mean, I guess that must be rife with a lot of problems of what was solvable. And presumably easier things are solvable, and so your reference there is, are they somehow?
So remember, all we're doing here is diagnosis, right? Diagnosis is essentially retrieval. So you take cases that other people have solved before you in all kinds of ways. It's only about retrieval, right? There's no hypothesizing here.
Got it.
All right.
Any other questions? Okay, great. Let's thank Gil.
Awesome. Thank you.